Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, covering topics of interest to lawyers handling civil appellate matters in Texas courts. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the Texas appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
We're privileged to have with us today Justice Paul Green from the Texas Supreme Court. Judge, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here. It'll be fun.
Well, Judge, you've been on the bench for quite some time. I didn't do the math, but between your time at the Fourth Court of Appeals, which we can get into, and your, I guess, 16 years now at the Texas Supreme Court.
Almost 16. 26 years.
Wow. I can't think of too many judges that have had a longer tenure as a judge than 26 years. That's really fantastic. Congratulations.
Thank you. Well, some of them, as you know, get frustrated and quit. I've had a lot of frustration, but I've tried to hang in there a little bit longer.
Well, before you took the bench, though, you were a practicing lawyer for quite a number of years. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I came out, you know, my father and my grandfather were both lawyers. And so I grew up around my dad's law practice, and I enjoyed going down to the office with him on weekends and just watch him push paper around on his desk, what it looked like to me. The typewriter and the copy machine and stuff like that. So, but I really just growing up, I wanted to be like him. He was an excellent lawyer. I wanted to practice law with him like he did with his dad. And so after law school, I joined that practice. It's about small eight person litigation firm, and learned a lot from him as well as many others. And did that for 17 years. You know, these days, a lot of people don't get to actually try cases because it's so difficult to get into the courtroom and all that. Well, back then, our law firm represented as a self-insured the three major taxicab companies in town. So they were getting sued all the time. They had targets painted on their doors. And so we were in court all the time, and I really got to learn a lot about practicing law and trying cases and so forth with that client.
Yeah, that's something you definitely don't see as much today as you did. That's great experience that you got to do that.
And I just enjoyed the practice of law and got involved in bar activities. The young lawyers and the senior bar, the bar association there, and enjoyed that a lot as well. And after my year as the president of the bar, somebody approached me one day and said, you know, there's going to be a whole lot of vacancies on the Fourth Court of Appeals. Like five out of the seven spots were going to be open. And would I be interested in running? And I thought, well, gosh, you know, I like trying cases. I like going around the country with my golf clubs, taking depositions and playing golf. What I hated was appeals. You would appeal a case. Either appellee or appellate. And I thought, I can't imagine wanting to do that. And so when I thought about it quite a bit, talked to my dad about it a lot, and it turned out to be pretty good timing insofar as the firm was concerned. And so I thought, well, okay, maybe this is an opportunity I just shouldn't pass up. And so I ran for the position and was elected, and it turned out I really liked it. You know, who knew? So I stayed there, and I was there for 10 years before I went on the Supreme Court.
Had you done a lot of appeals before you went on the appellate bench?
Not too many. I mean, probably, I don't know, 8 or 10, maybe something like that. Mm-hmm. Maybe a little bit more.
Well, there's definitely a strength of bringing a trial lawyer's perspective to the Court of Appeals, though, because, you know, there's so much of the intellectual pursuit of it, but having the practical experience, I bet, really gave you some insights that, you know, sometimes get lost on appeals.
You know, interestingly, back when I was on the Court of Appeals and running for election or re-election, people said, well, gosh, you haven't even been a trial judge. You know, what gives you the right to go seeking a job on the appeals court? I said, well, nobody wanted the job. All the trial judges didn't want to run for it. So they just sat there. So I thought, well, okay, well, I've spent a lot of time in the courtroom. I guess I don't really need to be a trial judge to know how to do this.
Well, who decided that you had to be a trial judge before you could become an appellate justice? I've never been a trial judge, but I've been practicing appellate law my whole career. You know, if I were going to run for judge, I think I'd be fairly well qualified.
Well, just people think of it as a natural progression, I guess. And but it doesn't have to be that way. Of course, we know some very good Supreme Court justices who've never been a trial judge or an appeals court judge. So just knowing what you're doing.
I've observed some of those Supreme Court justices, and, you know, in my experience, Even though they didn't have any judicial experience, they tend to grow into the job because they tend to take it very seriously and study and learn. And so many of them have been very humble about, you know, hey, I don't really know what I'm doing here. And, you know, I'm going to listen to folks like Justice Green, who've been around the block a few times.
Yeah, you see some of that, certainly on the Supreme Court, those that have been appointed and have not had time on a court before. But, you know, they do. They want to learn. They want to know the process and how things are the way they are. They bring a perspective that it's useful to the court anyway.
When did you decide or what made you decide that you wanted to go from the Court of Appeals to the Supreme Court?
That's an interesting story. Of course, you know, there's what, over 100,000 lawyers, only 9 of them Supreme Court. So the odds are not very good getting there. And I've really never played gotten involved in party politics. And so I knew I'd never get appointed to that position. And that maybe is an unfair thing to say. But what happened was I was reelected in 2000 to the Court of Appeals. In 2002, Phil Hardberger, who was Chief Justice of the Court, decided he was not going to run for reelection. So I decided to run for Chief Justice of the Court. It was challenged by one of my colleagues, Alma Lopez. And you may remember that was the year that Tony Sanchez ran for governor. And he was from Webb County, Laredo, and so was Alma. And they had a huge voter turnout down in Webb County. And so I got beat. And I told her later and others that was a blessing in disguise because I really wanted the job, but I would never have run for the Supreme Court 2 years later had I won that position. So then in 2004, some people approached me and said, you know, Stephen Smith had defeated Xavier Rodriguez, who was Governor Perry's appointee to the court. And he said, and the question was, you know, we think somebody ought to run against him in the primary. It's just really the way party politics works. You just don't run against somebody who's an incumbent in the primary, right? Typically, you don't. But I was encouraged by some people to do that. So I thought, well, you know, maybe this is what I can do. And so I started calling around to some of my judge friends, Houston, Dallas, and others, people I thought might know or would be interested in running for the job. None of them were doing it. It wasn't on their radar. I called my good friend who was the general counsel to the governor at the time and asked him what they were going to do. They said, well, we don't have any plans. We just want to run. So after thinking about it a while and talking to some people and kind of getting some things lined up, I decided to do it. By this time, it was August or September of 2003, and the primary was in March of 2004. And so I decided I'd really need some help to do this. And so I asked the governor's office if they would get behind me, and I needed to be introduced to a lot of statewide people. I never run statewide before. And they said, well, you know, we can't get involved in the primary. It's just not done. But I got a call from his political consultant one day, the governor's consultant, and said, you know, we just got out of a meeting and the governor was asking about this race. And we told him, says, well, he wants your help, but you can't get involved in it. He says, why the hell not? This guy Smith ran against my appointee. And if Green's a good guy, let's get behind him. Let's go. So off we went. And so we traveled around all over the state. The governor ended up traveling with me some places and introducing me around, and a great campaign. And I won the election and didn't have a November opponent in 2004. And so that I got elected and I stuck until now. Pretty good.
That is a pretty unique way, though. If you look at, you know, a lot of your colleagues, both now and in the last few years, you kind of were one of the unique ones to run, particularly against a sitting incumbent in a contested primary to get there.
Well, and you were on the receiving end of that, as I recall, in the last election cycle. And even more, to make it even better, I believe he had your same surname.
Yes, right. Yeah, the old Paul Green Rick Green race in primary, yeah. Yeah, that was very interesting. Quite an interesting time. Just a quick story. Yeah, it was a Republican primary that I was campaigning around in the state, got all these different women's club or men's club or something like that. But you're just talking to the Republican group. You want them to go vote for you in the primary, right? And so you say, of course, Rick or one of his surrogates was there talking about them. And I tell them, no, Rick Green, he's never even really practiced law. And if you think that I'm qualified and should be reelected, you need to vote for Paul Green, not Rick Green. Now, how are you going to remember that? You go, you tell your friends and your family, go vote for Paul Green, not Rick Green. Once they go into the voting booth, oh, was it Rick or was it Paul? But here's how you do it. Remember, there was a St. Paul, but there was no St. Rick. He says, okay, we got that.
That's really smart. That just hits so many notes. I can't even begin to get into it. But
well, you know, but it could, you know, you can say, well, maybe that helped. But I think what maybe helped more, because, you know, these down ballot races or even the Supreme Court level are not largely paid attention to by a lot of the voters. I understand that. And as it turned out afterwards, that of the top 10 voting counties in the state, I drew number one on the ballot in 8 of them.
Wow.
So that could have made the difference. Something like that. Red, green, Paul, green, I don't care who's number one. So check that one. No, but I've been blessed and been fortunate and really enjoyed it.
Attorneys are always trying to figure out the best, most efficient ways to stay on top of their game. Use QuickCheck on Westlaw Edge, a first-of-its-kind intelligent document analysis tool, to discover a new level of confidence. Simply upload a brief, yours or your opponent's, and in just minutes receive a report with warnings for cited authority, recommendations for additional relevant authority, as well as authority that is contrary to what your opponent cited. Improve the quality and thoroughness of your work without sacrificing time with QuickCheck on Westlaw Edge.
How was it going from being on the Intermediate Court of Appeals to the Supreme Court? Was there anything that kind of surprised you about transitioning roles?
I think that the big thing there is we get to filter the cases. Petition for review process, and of course, Court of Appeals, you take everything. I don't know, 50, 60% of the work on the court is deciding which cases we're going to take. And that was a big deal. And so you end up taking some really, pretty fantastic issue cases that way. That's been, and of course, good lawyer and good briefing. And that's making it a lot of fun too.
Well, then you also, your background as a civil lawyer, I'm sure it was some kind of adjustment going to the Court of Appeals and having to deal with criminal cases. And then going back to the Supreme Court and not having to deal with criminal matters anymore.
Yeah, that was nice. No Fourth Amendment, Fifth Amendment cases, you know, anymore. Arguing search and seizure law with my law clerks on the Fourth Court. Some of them were kind of far out there. But yeah, I certainly go to criminal procedure and I are not real good friends.
What are some of the different, you know, administrative or different roles you've had at the Supreme Court outside of your job just deciding cases?
Well, I've been blessed again there too. In fact, one of the first things that I did, I came on the court, Wallace Jefferson, who I've known for years from back in the San Antonio practice days. He was the Chief Justice at the time, of course. And so we were walking around the chambers and the court areas and looking around and said, this place is really shabby. He said, Paul, I want you to do what you have to do to kind of put something together and let's start updating these spaces. We did. We renovated the conference room, which looks terrific now. We renovated the roving room, which is a sad thing. You know, a lot of times we have ceremonial matters in the court and gather in the roving room before we go over to the courtroom with all the guests, the special guests and so forth. It would look terrible. We did some things like that. I really enjoyed that process. And so the court looks terrific now. And been up there and seen it. It's a really good outcome about that. The other thing I've done is been the liaison from the court to the Supreme Court Historical Society. And that's been lots of fun and great programs and raising money at the big dinners, the Hemphill dinners and stuff like that. In fact, the Hemphill is coming up September the 11th, and I will be doing recorded a Zoom swearing ceremony for Cynthia Timms coming in as the new president. But that's been great. I've been the longtime liaison to the Texas Young Lawyers Association Board of Directors. And what an energy-filled group of people those folks are. Over the years, you know, what the things that they've done, the programs they've come up with, the ideas they've had put in place, to really help not just lawyers, but to help the community and the people of the state that need the help. It's fantastic work. And then also the liaison to the litigation section, litigation council, and all the heavy duty work that they do in litigation programs and so forth, and state bar annual meeting stuff that they do and all that. It's been lots of very high quality people. And I've really enjoyed that too. I'm going to miss all of that.
That's really interesting. And you're right. Current Supreme Court space is beautiful. In fact, we were lucky enough to get to do our first episode up there right before COVID hit. That's the last time we've done anything in person. But the courtroom is just a fantastic space. And the whole area really is.
I love all the portraits being in there. It's great.
Which we put in in 2007, I believe it was, we put in the streaming video. Mm-hmm. Thanks to St. Mary's Law School. My alma mater. Now the state bar's taking it over. It's got high definition cameras in there. And they did such a fantastic job producing and recording all of those arguments like that.
Supreme Court's been a leader in that area. And, you know, we've talked about it a few times on the show. You know, even when the U.S. Supreme Court started having remote arguments and doing it by telephone, it just didn't do it justice. And if we're so spoiled to, you know, just being able to plug in non-COVID times and just watch any argument that we want to watch on any given argument day, it's really just a fantastic thing that the court's done and been able to continue to do. And it's just wonderful.
You know, one of the things this COVID situation has created an issue with me. I mean, I just, looking back, you know, you think about, okay, I'm retiring from the court and looking ahead. So, okay, I'm going to retire on that date. So I'll know when my last argument will be in the courtroom and I can just kind of soak it in and think this is okay. This is my last time. And the last, same thing with the last conference, sitting around the table in the conference room, looking at my colleagues and the staff, think, okay, this is my last conference, my career. I didn't get to do that. Because, you know, we all of a sudden they said, like, pull the plug and courts are shut down. We're not going back. I can look back and see when my last argument was or when my last conference was. My last argument was, by the way, Movac versus Escobedo, that case. Mm. And that was the end of it for me. I didn't know it at the time.
Well, we haven't really talked about this yet, Judge, but you've kind of gotten into it now. So why don't we just bring it out? You've announced your retirement from the court effective by the time this episode airs in September.
I've had my last conference with the court on Zoom. That was a hard conversation to have. You know, say, this is it. I love everybody at the court, the staff, the history, the tradition, the institution. And I feel sad about leaving, but I think it's my decision to timing. I think it's right for me. It's got to happen sometime. You know, so it's on my terms, and I look forward to the future, another chapter. Going to still do some things and have some fun, practice some law, and that sort of thing. So,
yeah. What made you decide timing wise to do it now? You've still got some time left in your term.
Yeah, there was a lot of factors involved. I've been looking at it for a year or two, and some personal matters that I thought that are kind of important for at least me and my family. And so, you know, my youngest son is his senior year in high school, and he's going to be gone. And we've done a lot of stuff together. I want to do some more things this year before he leaves. I wouldn't be able to do otherwise. So it just the timing wise, August 31 is the end of the court term. I thought it'd be great just to, you know, my staff is leaving, new staff is coming in, a new judge would be coming in with a new staff and start off with everybody else and a clean slate on the docket. It just seemed like a good time to do it.
So I heard you mention that you're going to be practicing law. Have you kind of made some plans for what you're going to do in retirement?
I have. I've actually accepted an offer with a law firm, which will be announced before too long. Mm-hmm. By the time of the podcast, it'll be coming out, but I'm going to defer on that announcement right now. But it's a great place. I've got a lot of good friends there, and so I'm looking forward to that.
Congratulations. I know that's an exciting change. Going from being a 20-something year appellate judge back to being a practicing lawyer, I'm sure will be an adjustment.
You're not kidding. Somebody about it says, you know, when I left law practice into going to the courts, and there wasn't such thing as a discovery plan, the limitations on depositions and timing and all that. You can take up as long as you want. All that kind of stuff has changed for the better, I think, but there's some things I'd have to relearn, and it's going to be a fun process. I think I'm going to have some people that'll help me.
What are some things, you know, you've been on an intermediate court of appeals, you've been on the Supreme Court now. What are some things that you've learned sitting on your side of the bench that you're going to take back to being an advocate, you know, on the other side now?
Oh, gosh, you know, trying to focus on what's the important things. I mean, I think when I was trying cases, you set up a plan about your case, you try your case according to the way you've planned it. Of course, everything happens during the trial. At the end of the thing, you're outraged because this didn't happen the way it should have happened. Maybe the trial judge didn't make a ruling the right way or something. But on the Court of Appeals and in the appellate process, you realize the other side of the bench, there's stuff that doesn't matter. It's something, and y'all will certainly understand that from what you do. You got to focus on things that matter and forget about all the little things that went wrong that aren't really going to affect the outcome of the case. The jury didn't care about that. Yeah, maybe it was wrong, but they didn't know. So I think being able to look at a case, a record, figuring out what is important, what is not, I've learned a lot about that. And I would tell practitioners, and y'all know this too, when you're trying a case, if you think it's going to be a Supreme Court worthy case, what's your theme going to be? What's the hook to get to the Supreme Court? What are you going to develop in the record so that the court understands this is different than just the run-of-the-mill kind of a case? and keep that theme in mind as you go through and try your case and then going up through the appeals process.
I wonder how many trial lawyers think when they're filing their lawsuit, oh, this case could wind up at the Texas Supreme Court.
I'm sure some do. And depending on the kind of case it is. I was thinking a little while ago about the kind of cases that we've seen on the Supreme Court over the years, and they kind of run in streaks. We had the healthcare liability cases. We've had the workers' compensation cases, the tax cases. Oh, I hated the tax cases. TCPA cases and so forth that have come along through there. But yeah, some of the in insurance cases, you know, you can tell when you're filing a lawsuit over, say, a provision in an insurance policy. It's a homeowner's policy. Everybody in the state has one. You can say, well, that's an issue that affects everybody. This could end up in the Supremes. Make sure you protect your record and all that kind of stuff.
Has the advent of e-filing changed the way that you look at briefs or you read briefs or kind of the things you look at when a case comes to you?
A little bit, perhaps. Well, certainly a lot easier. Don't drag around a 50-pound box full of petitions anymore. The briefings look pretty much the same, I guess. But I think the advent of e-filing has been fantastic. It's going to have huge ramifications down the road, too. I think at some point, the legislature is going to have to get busy and start restructuring the whole court system. Need all these clerks anymore because it's all electronically filed. And a lot of clerks that hear that don't like hearing that sort of thing, but not that anybody has to lose their job through attrition and so forth. But do you really need 14 court of appeals clerks? Do you need all the district clerks, county clerks? All this electronic filing is changing all of that. And somebody in El Paso wants to see a document that was filed in Beaumont, and they just pop it right up. There it is. So, yeah, there's going to be some changes about that over the maybe the next decade or so. But electronic filing has been great.
It certainly helped the court out during the recent ransomware attack. And
well, yeah, absolutely. And through this whole COVID thing, too. Yeah, gosh, the ransomware thing was just awful. They got to figure out a way to stop that sort of stuff from happening.
Yeah, it was a real double whammy for everybody. You know, you just get started kind of getting settled into the remote practice aspects of COVID, and then all of a sudden everything in all the appellate courts gets locked up and nobody can do any business.
Yeah.
That was the most frustrated I think I felt as an appellate lawyer is, you know, getting, I don't want to say teased, but getting very used to being able to access almost any information I wanted instantaneously, and then going from that to just dropping off a cliff. And being able to get nothing. And I think, you know, we're still recovering as a practical matter from that. And we're not back to 100% yet.
No, we had to put in all these additional security features like double password things and so forth like that at the court, trying to make sure that this doesn't happen again. And it will. In some form or another, it'll happen again. It's just because humans make mistakes. We've got to figure out a way to get back up on our feet a little bit faster.
Yeah. And, you know, the advantage of all the e-filing is I think we got a little bit spoiled with how easy it was to access everything until you realize you can't get to it. And then it really does. I mean, it was tough for everybody. Todd and I have had several episodes discussing, you know, once you get reliant on being able to download the record and get into the portals and upload everything and find all the filings online, not having access to that really does kind of cripple your ability to practice.
Yeah, I was at some point during this recovery process, I was looking for a letter that I'd written and, you know, keep all this stuff on my computer at the office. And apparently it's all on my C drive. And so I asked my executive assistant if she could find that letter for me and dig it around as well. It could be encrypted. So I got the message back. Yeah, everything on your C drive is encrypted. And forget about it. I had a lot of stuff on there. So important, but it just annoying is all get out.
So that got sucked up into the ransomware and it got locked down because of the attack?
Yeah. Everything that was hooked up together through the offices and so forth, everything wired together, and all those computers are wired together in some form or another. That bug just went in there and encrypted everything that's in everybody's computer.
That's so frustrating. I'm sure particularly for you because, you know, knowing that you're leaving and moving on to not be able to take some of that stuff with you.
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned before we started recording that you had been back to the chambers for the final time and had delivered your I guess, official letter to the governor. I always thought that when a justice retired and delivered a notice to the governor that that was it. But I've never heard of this other letter that you mentioned.
Well, it's just telling him that I'm essentially what I'm saying is herewith I'm delivering the letter notifying you of my resignation effective the end of the day, August 31. Of this year, so that formalizing, you know, because I talked to his office before I said, this is what I'm going to do. And they said, okay, we need to send a letter. I said, yeah, okay.
For most clients, a supersedeas bond is something they may need once in a lifetime, and very few surety brokers specialize in supersedeas bonds. If your client needs to stay enforcement of a judgment in Texas or any other state or federal court, Court Surety Bond Agency is the company to call. Learn more by visiting courtsurety.com today.
That's the official notice of the vacancy coming up and then the appointment process.
I guess before I delivered the letter, I could have changed my mind. But yeah, it was hard walking in there. I walked out the door and I thought, oh no, I've got one more thing I got to do. And I had to take my chamber key off my key ring and leave it on the desk. Walked out, and of course I have a key card badge to get in and out. They'll just turn that off at some point. I can't get in. I'm probably, other than as a guest of someone, I'm kind of done at the office now.
No more reserve parking space right there in the complex.
That's right. Boy, isn't that valuable. Sure is.
Very much so in that spot. You bet. Well, so it sort of raises the question about, you know, what's next for the court. Every time a justice leaves, it seems like some people kind of get up in arms about, oh no, we could have a tie vote, but that never really seems to be an issue. And of course, right now the courts, as you pointed out, the fiscal year is ending and the court's decided all its cases for the last term. So there really isn't anything coming out in terms of opinions or anything like that, and won't be for probably a while.
Probably till November.
Right. And so we're at this phase now where, you know, we're all kind of, once you're officially departed on Monday, then it kind of becomes a waiting game of, you know, what the governor's going to do as far as appointing your successor. And, you know, for those of us that are court watchers, we know that your successor fills out your unexpired term, which runs through the end of 2022, but has to run, they have to run in the next general. So it would be the November 2022 election.
So they'd be running for a full term.
Well, the timing of that works out great for the successor, because I've seen so many times folks having to run for a partial term, you know, like a 4 years.
Yeah, right. Or to run for 2 years, run for a 2 year remainder of the term, and then have to do it again for the long term.
Well, and unlike some of the,
as I mentioned earlier, the timing was such that I would hope that somebody could be appointed and step right in and start the new term with the court. I don't know what the governor's plans are, or if he has anybody in mind right now. They don't ask my advice or clue me in on what they're doing at this point, or even, I don't know if they even talk to the Chief Justice. But I'm hopeful that the governor will appoint somebody that's good. I bet he will, and I just hope sooner rather than later.
We're both anxious to talk today. Well, we've had some recent appointments to the court with Justice Bland and Justice Busby, and I know the governor interviewed a good number of people for those positions, and we still have some people who are good judges who were defeated in the last election cycle, who it might seem would be candidates for that position. That's certainly how it worked out with Justice Busby. So I know you can't speculate on that, but, you know, hopefully there would not be a really long period of time that would pass before the appointment was made, because there have been good people who've been lining up with their applications in hand, ready to, you know, take the oath.
Well, I would look for somebody whose initials are JB. If you got Jane Bland, JB, you got Justin Brett Busby, JB, you got Jimmy Blacklock, JB, you got Jeff Boyd, JB. So,
that, I'm sure that doesn't get confusing.
So if somebody out there with initials JB, then it seemed like a cinch.
Wow. I hadn't thought about that till you just said that, but wow, that is a lot of JBs at the court. It's
definitely a trend there.
You know, identifying things on everything. So we got a lot of JBs. So Busby decided he'll go with BB instead of JB. Justin Brett, so he goes Brett, so he cleared up a little bit of that. Lots of JBs.
That may be the most important qualification of all.
Could be.
Well, you've run a lot of, now you've run statewide races in addition to your broad geographic race, the races that you had to run for the San Antonio Court of Appeals. I bet you've developed some opinions about the judicial selection process in Texas. And my hope is that now that you're departing the bench, that you can speak freely about those opinions.
Well, you know, it's true. I mean, I've always been concerned about the process. I mean, a full-blown partisan fundraising advertising election process leads to certain things. And, you know, people act like politicians. And judges, I don't think, should be. You know, in my own case, and I can't speak for anybody else, but just for me, if you're going to pick a party, and I picked Republican, you run in the party primary and you have to do all those things that you have to do in a party primary. But I never waved the party flag. I never got involved in party activities, particularly when the primary was over. I said, okay, I'm running it for the job, but I'm not going to get involved as a party activist. Because I think once you've done that, you got another half of the country that said, okay, well, you can't be fair to me because you're waving the Republican flag. What does that tell me? So I've tried to avoid all of that. I think just if it's possible, can't get all the party politics out of the appointment system, but to the extent that you can, you should. And the money needs to come out too, I think. And get the money is a problem. Survey after survey, there's one going back 20 years ago that I can remember where 85% of the respondents said that they thought giving money to a judge or judicial candidate will affect judicial decision-making. Well, they think it's a corrupt system. So you get that many people that think it's a corrupt system, why wouldn't you change it? And of course, politics is involved. That's why you change it. So, I mean, and you say, well, go nonpartisan elections and so forth as well. Years ago, I was talking to a judge from Kentucky, and they have nonpartisan elections. And I said, well, that sounds much better than ours. He said, I wish we had something like that. He said, well, it doesn't make any difference. I said, what do you mean? So here's an example. I was out campaigning somewhere out in the countryside and came up on some people and said, I'm John Smith. I'm running for judge. And the guy said, well, are you a Republican or a Democrat? He said, no, you don't understand. In Kentucky, you don't run under party labels. The guy said, I understand that. Are you a Republican or a Democrat? He needed to know what kind of judge he's electing. So, I mean, there are clues that you can get for party affiliation, I suppose. But the main thing is, I would hope that we all take an oath, try to follow the law the best we can, don't, you're making up as you go along. I've had some disappointments in my time on the two courts, particularly going back to the Court of Appeals, where I'm not sure that the oath was quite followed as much as it should have been. In some circumstances, a lot of funny things happened, and, you know, ex parte communications and so forth. I mean, it's just really sad. In fact, here's a quick story. I was sitting at my desk one time, and I had a lot of friends, still do, here in San Antonio. One of them was a personal injury lawyer. We'd play golf together all the time. He's a good friend of mine. I considered him a good friend. And one day the phone rang. I was in my chambers and I actually had a case, and he was a lawyer in one of the cases that we had. And he called up and I thought he was going to talk about playing golf, getting together to play golf. But what he wanted to know was whether he should settle his case. How's my case looking? And I said, I can't believe you're asking me that. So we got off the phone and I hadn't talked to him in 20 years. That was the end of it. I just couldn't believe that. And, you know, some folks will take those kind of calls. But it's those are disappointing instances, circumstances, but and it's a sad situation, at least in my relationship with him. But you got to get a lot of that stuff out of the court. Money, politics, the best you can. Let people decide cases on the basis of what the law is.
It'll be interesting to see what happens. It seems like there's some momentum to change the system, maybe more than we've seen in a while. So I don't know. It'll be interesting to see in the next couple of years if anything shakes out of that process.
Yeah.
Starts with the legislature, and I think they're going to have their...
I heard that the governor's behind doing something. I thought for a long time, nothing's going to happen unless the governor gets behind it. But I understand the lieutenant governor's not so hot on the idea. He's got to get on board, too. But the other problem is, if you start making changes, see, well, we're going to go to this really good system where your judicial candidates are vetted, goes to an appointed process, whatever system like that, so forth, but they're appointed. The person who doesn't like that sort of thing is going to say, well, they will tell the people out there, they're going to take away your right to vote, and then it's over. Is that going to happen? So I've been in favor of a change for 26 years now. It can happen, but as much as it probably should.
And there's a lot of your former colleagues, particularly the former chiefs, that, you know, go up every session and speak out about it. So there's definitely a lot of voices out there asking for something different.
I'm going back to Greenhill and John Hill and Tom Phillips, all of the former chiefs have been in favor of making changes, but it hasn't been the political will to do it.
Well, I want to totally change course and ask you about something fun. Okay. I understand you're a pilot.
Yes. Yes, I've enjoyed that. I've been doing about 10 years ago, something I've always wanted to do. About 10 years ago, I thought, no, you know, I don't want to do this. And so, there'd be in the afternoons, I'd driving from Austin to San Antonio, I'd stop off in New Braunfels, meet my flight instructor, get some more hours in, and that sort of thing. Finally got it done. And I've had a ball flying. When the court hears cases out of town, some places that are hard to get to driving, it's like easier to fly, like in Huntsville, for example, or various places out of West Texas. I'm flying, boys. You can drive if you want. Actually, it took Jeff Brown and Jeff Boyd with me. We flew over to Huntsville and back, and that trip that we had out there to hear cases. The young lawyers and the litigation counsel always have interesting places to go, like at the Gage Hotel in Marathon and other places out of West Texas, and we fly out there. I really get a kick out of it. And my son, my senior in high school, has got his pilot's license. He's trying to get all kinds of things. He's got his pilot's license, his complex aircraft endorsement, his high performance endorsement, and his tailwheel endorsement already, which is
wow.
Right where I was. He's been
that's incredible.
You have a friend who has an old biplane that needed to be recovered, and so he flew it all the way from San Antonio to Battle Creek, Michigan, to get it delivered up there get it recovered. So he's really good.
It's amazing.
I wouldn't even know where to start on any of that.
It's a lot of fun. Like I said, it's something I've always wanted to do. My father was in the Army Air Corps. One of my grandfathers was a pilot too. Yeah, I just said, I'm just going to do this.
Did you say, did I hear you right, that you really just picked it up within the last 10 years or so?
Yeah. 10 years ago is when I started flying.
Wow.
Hopefully you'll have some time to really enjoy it, you know, in the next little bit now that you're stepping away from the court.
Yeah, I think so. And particularly with Ethan needing to do some more flying. We're going to fly some this year while he's in his senior year and get some more things accomplished for him where he goes off to college, wherever that's going to be. Another reason I'm leaving the court, make a little bit more money maybe. Pay for that.
My oldest son just started college. I totally understand. That's a different level of parental commitment.
Yes, it is.
We want to be respectful of your time, and this is kind of when we usually wrap up. We just wondered, you've given some great stuff. We just wondered if you had a tip or a war story that you'd like to share here as we close out our episode.
I guess in terms of, I'd just tell you a war story. I mean, you'd ask, think of something, and what always comes to mind about war stories goes back to the Fourth Court of Appeals, and there is a prominent appellate lawyer down there that we'd see all the time. I'm not going to mention his name, but you would know him. And so back then, the lawyers would come in and make their arguments and so forth, but nobody thought to have a pitcher of water and glasses on the council tables. So one time came time for this lawyer to make his argument. He stood up at the podium, reached into his jacket, pulled out one of those little airline whiskey bottles. It was empty. He said, well, there's water in it. He said, this is like a little Jack Daniels bottle or something. It had water in it. He says, sometimes, you know, I get up here, get a little dry mouth, so I want you to just know it's not whiskey. It's just water. We kind of sat back and said, okay. And sure enough, during his argument, he stopped, opened up the cap, and lost that thing. And so the next day of arguments, we had pitchers of water and glasses out there for everybody. Felt bad for the guy.
Oh, gosh.
That was what it took to make that change, was somebody bringing in what had been a bottle of whiskey. Wow.
And of course, a tip to your listeners who won't need this tip anyway, but there have been more than a couple of times where we had nervous lawyers talking to us. And I remember we were sitting in the panel, I think it may have been an en banc panel in San Antonio. And back when I was there, this is another funny thing, I was the only man on a 7-judge court. There were 6 women and me. And the lawyer that was arguing, a little nervous about the situation, and kept talking to the panelists, you guys. Well, it didn't go well with the ladies.
Ooh.
you understand who your audience is.
Absolutely.
No doubt.
That's the other thing. When I left the court to come to the Supreme Court, it was 6 women and 1 man, and the governor appointed Rebecca Simmons to replace me, making it an all-female court. They got a lot of press over that. I never got any credit for leaving the court to allow that to happen. I fuss at them all the time about that. Wouldn't have happened without me, ladies.
Well, you can remind them the next time you see them all when you're there in San Antonio, because I imagine you'll be seeing some of those judges fairly soon. Justice Green, it's been a pleasure to have you on the show. We're honored to have you and so glad we could do it before you left the court. Mm-hmm. And we wish you the best in your practice as you move ahead. And we'll look forward to the announcement of where you're going to be landing, because I have observed that when a Supreme Court justice leaves the court, it's always pretty tight-lipped as far as where they're headed afterward, and for good reason. So, but thanks again for spending the time with us today.
I enjoyed it.
We did too. And good luck on all your new adventures coming up.
Thank you. Thanks, gentlemen.
Thank you. Before we go, we'd like to pause for a moment and thank our sponsors, Thomson Reuters and Court Surety Bond Agency. We appreciate their support.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you're enjoying the podcast, please recommend it to colleagues you think might benefit from listening.
Taking the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts would be great too. We appreciate everyone who's rated us so far.
And if you have questions, thoughts, or comments, please shoot us an email at hosts@texapplawpod.com. Message us on Twitter or Instagram @texapplawpod, or reach out through the podcast's Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you.
Until next time, we wish you all the best and hope you're staying safe and healthy.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. To stay in touch with your hosts, suggest topics, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or on Twitter @texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.